to the group, good to see you. It has been quite a beginning to 2025. In the first week alone, we have the Prime Minister announcing his intention to resign as leader after 9 years. He prorogues Parliament and in the same breath launches a Liberal leadership race to replace him. And then throughout the week, and then the week ends with what we're calling the Trump administration 2.0 and the people associated with it, basically stirring the pot politically, the Canadian political pot, with provocative commentary. If you think Wayne Gretzky being Prime Minister of Canada is provocative, but nevertheless, clearly stirring the pot with talk of annexation and discussion around Greenland and, you know, commentary made about the various leadership players in Canadian politics. And then with the Liberal Party formalizing its rules for a leadership race that is going to be very truncated, probably unlike any leadership race we've seen at the national level, maybe ever, but certainly for a very long time. So for our podcast today, we really want to take a look and dive into what this all means for the Canadian national political landscape, and in particular for the ongoing business of government in Ottawa. You know, from running the country to running a leadership race to preparing and being in a position to properly, you know, deal with an incoming presidential administration, the docket is very full. Let's start talking about prorogation. So, you know, we've seen prorogation before, but what actually does it mean? And maybe I'll throw to you first, Guy. Like, so so does the government just shut down? What's happening at this point now in Ottawa from your perspective?
So prorogation, surely put, is the shutting down of a parliamentary session, which, because parliament only exists in sessions, means the shutting down of parliament for that period of time. Prorogation used to be very routine. It was so routine that in parliaments and legislatures it would occur almost annually. We talk about it more, and it's more unusual because prorogation is at the federal level and in some of the provinces used a lot less frequently. You know, just two things. First of all, you mentioned that the Prime Minister prorogued. Technically, he advised the Governor General and she prorogued, and it's still a prerogative of the Governor General to decide whether it's properly constitutional to accede to that or to act on that advice. And a Governor General doesn't have to act on that advice if the Governor General feels that it's being used for what I'd call an unconstitutional purpose. In terms of what it means for Parliament shut down, the workings of Parliament shut down. I mean, staff members of Parliament, senators, continue to go to work, get their pay. Members of Parliament and senators get their pay and continue constituency work. But the House of Commons and the Senate and House committees, Senate committees, joint committees do not operate. It also means that all legislation that is before either House of Parliament dies. It must be reintroduced in order to restart and restart its legislative journey.
Can't be business as usual.
Well, for the Parliament, it isn't. For government, it is often. I mean, policy development continues. Government employees administer programs, issue passports. I mean, the work of the government continues. And for those who work for cabinet ministers and the Prime Minister, they are involved dealing with stakeholders, thinking about policy, managing issues, doing all the things they normally would. What the executive branch of government no longer has to deal with during the prorogation period is the in-person, live, day-to-day accountability of the executive to the parliament.
But in this case, like, so again, it strikes me though that like this is a different prorogation than others. Like, there's a bit of a leadership vacuum, isn't there, Alex and Claudia? Like, we have a prime minister, but he's already said he's leaving. And I guess now we know that there are a number of cabinet ministers who aren't going to be candidates for the leadership, but there may still be some who are, and the business of government has to continue. But how is a practical matter, like, who's taking orders from whom here? There is a legislative agenda, but from officials to political staff to, you know, who's following orders here and from whom?
Well, I'll leave Alex to comment in a little bit more color, but this is not an ordinary prorogation. As Guy pointed out, I mean, prorogation is not unfamiliar to Canadians. And but as you said, Dan, at the beginning, you alluded to the beginning, the context is very different. We do have a Liberal government that, led by Prime Minister Trudeau, that is now 9 years in. So it's coming toward an end in any event.
A natural end
in any event. And Prime Minister Trudeau obviously has already announced his resignation pending the new leader being named in, as you pointed out, a very truncated leadership race. And all of this against the backdrop of the inauguration, pending inauguration. So, Alex, maybe you can give more color in terms of, you know, the role of the PMO and the PMO's office in how policy gets developed.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Claudia. And thanks, Guy, for that well done overview of prorogation. But essentially, everything stays the same, but for everything is different. And you have to think about it in the perspective of the fact that there was a cabinet shuffle right before the Christmas break. And it seems so far removed from us right now because of the events of last week, but 12 ministers changed roles. So 12 ministers right now are getting the briefing books from their departments, learning new files, trying to build up their teams in the midst of a prorogation when everyone's expecting an election come spring. So that's one thing going on right now in Ottawa that's affecting how business takes place. The second is the Prime Minister has essentially announced to the entire system that there's an end date to his tenure. And the moment you do that, the system starts working against you. And that happens in multiple ways. One way is on the political staffer side. The Prime Minister's office has been increasingly centralized over the years. Many people have written about this, and I'm trying to say this in the least partisan way possible, but it does mean that a very centralized office has kind of lost its moral persuasion abilities. So offices are less likely to follow them, especially when ministers are trying to think through their own political fortunes and futures, they'll do what's in the best interest of them. And the second thing that changes is the bureaucracy. So already the bureaucracy is making considerable efforts at predicting what a future conservative government will look like, will want to focus on, and will, you know, try to steer the current apparatus towards being able to accommodate that. So not only is the bureaucracy already doing that, and you can look to former clerks who are out on all public media suggesting that they're doing that, but now you have a prime minister who's essentially said that he is no longer going to be running the show. And so now they're going to try to future proof for the next leader. So,
right. So, yeah, so here we are. Uncertainty reigns. Well, okay. So what does that mean? I don't want to cast you, Andrew, in the role of opposition leader here for our podcast, but and Guy, this isn't a partisan question, but opposition parties, they oppose governments, and Parliament provides them a forum in which to actively be seen to be opposing government, providing an alternative. None of that's happening now, at the same time as you have what's happening with the incoming U.S. administration and the preoccupation the Canadians have about, like, what are we going to do in the face of some of the things, if not all of the things, that have been floated by the incoming president?
So at a surface level, I mean, this is all coming up roses for Pierre Poilievre. Like, every single day, the hits just keep coming against Justin Trudeau and in favor of Pierre Poilievre. But it creates its own complexity. If I can butcher a sports analogy, you know, if you swing at every single pitch, there is a chance that you tire yourself out, that you, in the eyes of the public, are seen as being trapped in an opposition mentality, as opposed to pivoting strongly and quickly to that prime minister in waiting mode. And you see such, I think, contrasting examples from the opposition right now. You really see people maturing in their roles, preparing for what is to come. Being a government that we think and I think many people hope will interact and relate to Mr. Trump in a way that can achieve a peaceful outcome and an honorable outcome. And then you also see tinges of certain temptations towards a pugilist nature, you know, sort of call back to pure opposition days where we can't resist swinging at that pitch. It's just too good. And this is a real challenge because you see Danielle Smith spend part of her weekend at Mar-a-Lago. And then it sort of raises the question of, well, is that what Pierre Poilievre should do? Should he be taking advantage of these precious few days before inauguration to just make good? And it all depends on what you think about where the Canadian public's heart and heads are at as they look at that imagery. So much of politics is the imagery and how people react at an emotional level. Do they want to see Pierre Poilievre in a like-minded fashion, making meaningful headway, standing with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago? Or do they want to see sort of more of a Captain Canada motif where someone is fighting back and pushing back? And I got to say, I'm still making up my mind on this. I am leaning towards someone who's going to defend our interests. And I sort of feel this at an emotional level, even when Trump is making fun of Justin Trudeau. As someone who comes from the blue team, I'm still reacting a little bit.
Claudia, what do you think? I mean,
there's a real tension here. I mean, again, to this whole point of it not being an ordinary prorogation, I mean, you don't normally have also, you know, the impending inauguration and the sort of economic nationalistic threats that are coming out. I mean, that is become something that should be a unifying force, notwithstanding what I think, Andrew, one of the things you're speaking to, which is sort of the usual knee-jerk reaction, which is we're now in opposition mode, we're fighting an election domestically. But with this imperative coming, you know, in terms of from the U.S., I'm not sure that how that's going to play out, to your point, Andrew, in for Canadians.
I don't like Elon Musk being out there kind of shilling for a little bit, if I understand correctly, sort of shilling a little bit for the conservative leader. I think it puts him in an awkward position a little bit for the reasons even you alluded to, Andrew. Like the stuff we've been hearing from south of the border, from the president elect, we never heard anything like that before, and it certainly seems to have created a bit of a rallying cry, sort of tugging on Canadians' patriotic sort of sensibilities. And so how do you manage that, both defend the country, be perceived to be defending the country, while also do the important work of trying to build relationships with the incoming administration? Guy, given all of, like, I think it is unprecedentedly sort of uncertain times in the Canadian context within the government. Do you think the government has the capacity to properly organize itself to be able to be ready to go on January 20th, or are we going to see this thing kind of evolve over time?
So on that point, let's go back. I think that, as Claudia and other people said, this is an exceptional circumstance. It exceptional because of the leadership vacuum, which is either imminent or has already occurred. It's not because of prorogation. I mean, it's part of our system, is right? There's always a government, there's always a prime minister, there's always people in charge. The fact that Parliament is not sitting, certainly has an accountability dimension to it. Like, government can't be held accountable. There's also issues for appropriations and spending, but you can still lead. The challenge really is that the prime minister has announced his intention to resign. And like, I've seen this in other governments, every time a first minister announces he or she is on the way out, the capacity of the center to hold everything in check disappears. Right. And that's, I guess, your question, Dan,
yeah,
is, you know, can a prime minister and therefore a prime minister's office that now no longer has any of the levers, any of the tools they use to both lead and keep people in check and in line, it's a tall order.
Well, and Andrew mentioned the Premier of Alberta, but you know, the premiers of the provinces, I mean, Premier Doug Ford in Ontario, he's not waiting. He's decided he's going to have his own.
And why would a premier? But even that, why would a minister?
Right.
Why would a department? Like, I'm thinking of the government of Canada as well. I mean, the ability of PCO's influence and control is partly a function of its role as a central agency, but partly derived from the prime minister. And when the prime minister has announced, essentially, there's, you know, I'm checking out, ministers, their staffs do their thing, departments go back to their steady state, which is for a department to do its own thing, unchecked by the center. I think it's a tall order to for the government of Canada to take a sort of a consistent approach to what's happening in that environment.
Listen, let's turn just to talk a little bit about the Liberal leadership race. I want to preface this by saying this conversation is going to be largely nonpartisan. We're not here to critique particular candidates or endorse any other candidates. I mean, we could be pretty blunt if you want about our assessments of the political dynamics around it. But I do think it's interesting. You know, it's the list of potential candidates was quite long to start. It seems to be shortening rather quickly. I'm wondering, Alex, what your take on where things are at now and who you think we're likely to see. I'm assuming Mark Carney, if he decides to run, we can speculate on that. I think there's a decent chance he's already decided to run. Chrystia Freeland and Christy Clark, those seem to be the three names that are sticking out there. But what's your sense of this race, how it's shaping up at the beginning? And then I'll throw it to you, Andrew, and ask you what you think the opposition's perspective on it's going to be and how it's going to manage it during this. What is a sort of truncated period?
Yeah, I think like any good race, this one has started with a lot of people floating their names, and it's going to winnow down awfully quickly. I have to say, I appreciated Brian Gallant's intervention. So there's a good tradition in the Liberal Party of a New Brunswick premier floating their candidacy for a few days before withdrawing. And in this instance, Brian Gallant did it for, I believe, 2 hours on Friday. So outside of the New Brunswick Liberal premiers, we've had a lot of names coming forth, a lot of senior cabinet ministers. At the very onset, we saw the Intergovernmental Affairs and Finance Minister Dominic LeBlanc saying that his important responsibilities preclude him from running. That's a very popular pick in caucus as someone who could sort of hold down the fort into an election. A seasoned political vet, has a lot of respect amongst those in Ottawa. Melanie Joly has suggested something similar on Friday, that her responsibilities at foreign affairs preclude her from running, but she was very convinced she could actually win this thing. Lesser names, such as in the public imagination at any rate, Steve McKinnon, who's a former senior executive of the party and a labor minister who's gotten some attention.
A senior member of Paul Martin's team, political team, when he became prime minister.
With great political chops and a fluently bilingual person from Prince Edward Island, actually, who represents a Gatineau riding. Has decided yesterday not to run. Anita Nan, who is another one who's been long touted as a future Liberal leadership convention, has decided not to run and has announced that she's quitting political life, or at least suspending her political career at this juncture. So who's left? So names that are floated and in no order of preference. So Mark Carney, as people have mentioned, has long been rumored to have leadership ambitions. And by all accounts that you can read and what you can hear internally, is gearing up to launch a campaign in the coming days. Chrystia Freeland, whose exit from the cabinet in December sort of precipitated the prime minister's resignation, is also being understood to be considering a leadership bid. So we should find out more in that respect.
What's the price of admission?
So the last time the Liberals did this, it was about $75,000 for Justin Trudeau's election, and this time they've upped the stakes to $350,000. So it's a lot of money, and you have to raise it by January 23rd. There's talk about it being in installments, but people have to understand that just because you may be independently wealthy, you can't just put your own money into it. It's 1750.
The election financing rules kick in here, right? They apply to this. It's not a free for all, correct?
It's all regulated by the Canada Elections Act. That's right, including as Alex said, contribution limits. There are not statutory spending limits. There may or may not parties that can set their own spending limits, but contributions are absolutely regulated. And as Alex said, you get it from ordinary human beings who are Canadian citizens or permanent residents in the country up to their limits. And it's a long haul to get to any number in those increments.
So that kind of is going to narrow the field organically, because the other realistic people who can actually put forward that type of organization to get that sort of cash is Christy Clark, the former provincial Liberal premier of British Columbia. And I make that distinction because the weekend had a bit of a snafu on her part, because she had denied ever being a member of the Conservative Party. But the Conservative strategist, Jenny Byrne, had the receipts of her membership because she had voted for Jean Charest and had been very public about it at the time. So Jean Charest. Christy Clark, I mean, potentially Jean Charest, who knows? But Christy Clark, Chrystia Freeland, and Mark Carney are seen as the likely three to go forward. There's a couple of other names. Frank Bayliss was a former member of parliament who ran a very successful company and had sold it, and who's been known to be gearing up for a run for quite some time. He's announced an intention. And a local Ottawa member of parliament, Chandra Aria, has very much announced his candidacy, though questions remain whether he'll be able to and put forward the money. And the last one I failed to mention was the current government House Leader, Carina Gould, who's a member of parliament from Burlington, who seems to be creating her own structure and has suggested an interest in.
And just quickly, do we have a debate scheduled, a certain number of debates? What's the format? How are we going to be able to, how are Canadians going to get and Liberals going to get an opportunity to view these candidates?
So Liberals are able to vote as long as they're registered Liberals by January 27th. So you have to carefully go through the Liberal Party's website to find the button to register. It's free to be a member. The rules have been circumscribed to diminish the threat of foreign interference. So permanent residents and citizens above the age of 14 are allowed to vote. It had previously been a lot wider and had been a cause for concern for many in that sense. No debate schedule has been put forward at this juncture. You can expect the party to work with the media to at least put forward an English and a French language debate. But this is a tight race till March 9th to get all this done.
Andrew, so leadership races can be wonderful opportunities for opposition politicians and parties to have at the party that's trying to conduct a leadership race. What do you think the Conservatives and the NDP and the Bloc, how the opposition parties generally will be kind of positioning themselves through this? Is it in their interest just to try to be as not disruptive, but, you know, to be as vocal as possible? Or is it better just to sit back and let the leadership race run its course?
So there's a couple of schools of thought here. I think one school of thought is don't interrupt your enemy while they're embarrassing themselves. That's not the school that's being followed by the Conservatives. They've really adopted a take no chances, take no prisoners approach. And you saw that, as alluded to by Alex, over the weekend. Christy Clark says, I was never a conservative. I've never even spoken with a conservative. I don't know what you're talking about. And the next thing you know, that the screen grab of her full name from the Conservative Information Management System, you know, they've got her dead to rights, documented as a card-carrying conservative, albeit, you know, for the purpose of, in her estimation, trying to stop Pierre Poilievre from winning by supporting Jean Charest. It's just an early and unforced error. And the people who do this kind of research inside the Conservative Party are very, very good at their jobs. They're not going to miss an opportunity. They could have taken a pass. They ain't gonna. And you really saw evidence of that over the weekend. So they're really seeking to frame these people in the infancy of their potential leaderships. Carbon tax Carney. You know, just even the alliterated name calling.
The Conservatives and the Bloc seem to be spending a lot of time on Mr. Carney.
I think he's perceived as the front runner by the opposition parties. And with the Conservatives so far ahead in the polls, you might have thought they might just take a pass. But no, that is not the MO. That's not how these folks do things. And they're not missing a beat. You know, they are already seeking to frame these people in the eyes of the public.
So Claudia, the rest of us on this podcast, Guy is very decidedly and purposefully nonpartisan. I describe myself as a retired political hack who's postpartisan. I won't pretend to define or describe Andrew and Alex in terms of their partisanship, except to say that all four of us have worked for one of the two leading political parties. You have not. Mm-hmm. What's your take on the leadership? You know, you have a candidate, Mark Carney, that people know a little bit about, but not that much, hasn't been a politician. Chrystia Freeland, who has been a politician and may have the merits and demerits of being closely associated with the current government. So give us your nonpartisan, purely nonpartisan take on Liberal leadership races.
I think one of the challenges that somebody like Mark Carney, I think, has is that, the politics is its own beast, and you can be an extremely accomplished in all, you know, variety of different areas, as clearly he is. But there is sort of the cut and thrust of politics. There's the door-to-door, you know, meeting people, you know, getting to know people, that kind of sort of more retail kind of
politics. It was a thing that Justin Trudeau excelled at, right? Like he actually, in the end, he showed up.
He did a lot of that, you know, sort of, and of course, we're now in this very short period of time. There isn't really an opportunity. It's, you know, if he wants to run, now's the time to do so. But But that's, I think, is a real weakness. And whatever else, Chrystia Freeland, you know, will have had to, for good and for ill, experienced some of that. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays itself out. That knowledge, that ability to kind of roll with what are can be sometimes difficult punches in political life. So that's one of my comments related to how he might play out.
So I worked, as you all know, with Michael Ignatieff, and as so he there are some parallels. I don't want to overstate this or over, you know, there are some parallels between a Mark Carney candidacy and a Michael Ignatieff candidacy. Of course, importantly, what we're talking about is not having the sort of retail political experience. Now, Michael Ignatieff was elected to parliament before he ran to be leader of the party, but just barely. As I recall, on the election night when Paul Martin stepped aside and announced his intention to resign, Michael Ignatieff found himself as the front runner. So a person with no real political experience, who had a significant experience outside the country. As I recall, he apparently, according to the Conservatives, he didn't come back for us, but there was a perception that he was, you know, out of touch and an elite. And I think, Mark Carney is very much connected to Canada, has been here a lot, arguably a lot more in his professional life, but he was governor of the Bank of England, for example. He definitely is an elite. And so I just, that's a question mark as to whether or not that, how that plays out, again, from a retail political point of view, but a very short campaign, it's going to be hard for him to have really that many opportunities to create a perception if he runs, and then, or for Canadians to form a perception. But again, for good and for ill. I will offer it up to Andrew and Alex to have a final comment on that if they want. Did Mark Carney come back for you?
I'm gonna regretfully choose not to wade into this despite my instincts. But I will take a broader comment of one thing about this race that's going to be quite interesting to follow is it's actually 338 races. So each of these organizational structures is going to have to win Liberal members in each riding. And for a campaign like Mark Carney's, it's going to be quite interesting to follow is how is he going to be able to get voters in the various Saskatchewan ridings, Manitoba ridings, BC ridings, if his structure is kind of situated in Ottawa. And I'm not saying that he's not being successful in that. I saw on the weekend that Anne McClellan in Alberta, a former Liberal cabinet minister from Edmonton, seems to be one of the early endorsers of Mark Carney. But it will be a logistical challenge for a campaign like that, because someone like Chrystia Freeland has been elected for over a decade, has toured the country as a Liberal member of parliament, and will naturally have had those relationships.
Yeah. Andrew, is organization going to be key?
I think it will be, but I think that overconfidence in both directions is the real danger here. I think that for the Liberals to believe that no, there's a path here, there's a path, and we just need to pick the right person and follow it, that may not be true. I mean, the hole may be too deep, and that's really going to impact the leadership race and the breadth of the field.
Is the party then turning to elect an opposition leader? Is that where the mind goes?
I mean, on the numbers, that is what you would conclude, that this is a longer term plan, and that if someone like Mark Carney wins, he's got to make a long-term commitment to climbing out of that hole. I think the danger for the Conservatives is to conclude that there's no path here. We are so far in front that this is this is written in the stars for us, because that is, of course, when you make mistakes. And I think we've heard repeatedly, anecdotally, in some of the polling, that if there were a sensible Liberal leader, a lot of people would consider that person. So the question is, does Mark Carney get to frame himself as that sensible alternative, or do the Conservatives frame him first as out of touch, elite, and unsuitable to lead? And that's why I think you see so much effort on both sides of that equation. The race is already underway, and the race is around framing and who gets to create the message frame around the next Liberal leader.
Two very quick points on what Andrew said is, one, and you can look at Spark Advocacy and Nanos, but there's about 10 to 16% of Canadians who are more likely to be interested in voting for the Liberal Party under a new leader. So that's a game changer for the Liberal Party right now. And two, to Andrew's point, very few Canadians actually know who Mark Carney is. So it is a steep hill to climb in a very, very short race.
And that's just one hill. I guess, Dan, I think we could sort of, I go back to the topic we identified at the very beginning of this conversation. Leadership races are interesting to follow. You know, it seems exciting. So Canadians, you know, may or may not be engaged in this. But the challenge we all face as Canadians is that at the end of this process, two things will happen. Donald Trump will be the 47th president of the United States. Canada will still have to address those issues. And it's a very short time frame for all Canadians to deal with this. We have right now, as we've established, a prime minister who is on his way out and has the constitutional authority, but may not have the actual ability to get things done. There'll be a new Liberal leader on March 9th. Parliament may or may not return on March 24th, and either by the design of a Liberal party, which advises dissolution, we could end up in an election campaign, or by the design of the opposition parties, which come together, we have an election campaign. Election campaigns are 36 to 50 days. So we're looking at many, many months before Canada is you know, knows clearly who is going to be leading us, representing us, and advocating for us on the world stage, and more importantly, the continental stage.
Listen, let's end on this then. A simple question, which I will answer first. And the question is, are we in an election campaign on March 24th? In other words, does the House come back and are there votes of confidence and the government falls in that way or otherwise is extended because one of the opposition parties holds them up? Or does an incoming Liberal leader dissolve Parliament? And so my vote on that, I think it's a little hard to tell with any precision, but I have to believe that the Parliament's dissolved. I don't think we're coming back for a throne speech, and I don't think we're gonna that's gonna be the choice facing the new Liberal leader. Andrew, what do you think?
I think dissolution. If I'm on the Liberal side of the equation, I think I want to seize the agenda. I don't want to lose in front of the Canadian public. I think there's an emotional attachment to that. That is how governments fall. But I think if there's a new leader, there's a fresh approach. You can make your speech in the form of a platform. You don't need to make it a speech from the throne on which you go down.
Claudia?
I want to be contrary, but unfortunately, I would go with dissolution. I do feel like you have a little bit more control, a bit more authority, and it's a government that's been running on fumes for a while. So that's what would be my vote. I hope somebody votes differently, just to have a different response. But that would be my view.
No, I agree. I agree with everybody.
I was going to come to you, Guy, with a question, okay. An addendum, supplemental. So Alex, first.
Sure. I'll throw in the caveat here, just to be distinctive, and to say a day in politics is a very long time. Right now, the Liberals are polling terribly. They're neck and neck with the NDP. That has convinced the NDP to go and vote against this government and defeat it. In 2 months from now, it might be a very, very different story. So I will leave it with that caveat, and then I'll be very practical for a moment to suggest, assume the votes come in and a leader is declared on March 9th. That leader will celebrate and quickly have 15 days to swear in a new cabinet, figure out what they want to be in their throne speech, and prepare for an election before the House is supposed to come back on March 24th. And I have been in these transitions before, as have a number of you on this screen, and they are often done in a question of months and not days. So that's a lot of preparation only to fall, when you can instead call your own election and chart your course. And on a personal level, I don't know how the personalities who choose to run will want to be known in Canadian history as prime minister for a few days in that sense.
Right. So Guy, my supplemental, which I'll add to your question, is before I ask you what you think, government coming off of prorogation with the start of a new session, the convention starts with a throne speech. But a throne speech doesn't have to be voted on, does it? Doesn't have to be a vote of confidence, does it? It isn't necessarily the first kick at the can that opposition parties have.
There's a long answer to that. The short answer is that a lot of times speeches from the throne are read, and then there's a motion for an address and reply, and the vote is actually not on the speech, but on this motion, which essentially thanks the Governor General for the gracious speech, or it is voted down or amended. But there are a lot of examples where that vote is never taken, and it's quite possible for that vote never to occur. But that is that's a constitutional problem. It's a constitutional problem because the delay in a vote on that resolution, or the motion for an address and reply, is actually a delay of a test of the confidence of the House in the ministry. So it's a thing, but no, it doesn't have to be voted on immediately. And by the way, I agree with everyone. I think the more likely outcome is dissolution and a new election. You know, things are different now in this with this social media, just the way we think. There's an old kind of thinking, which is, you know, people really focus on a speech from the throne, and they'll look at what the government's offering, and they'll dare the opposition to come by and vote against these good things. And I just think in this day and age, ability of any party to focus on a speech from the throne and make that an issue and have Canadians outraged, either that it's voted up or voted down, it is really not how politics works or how Canadians think these days. So I think dissolution is more likely.
Okay, well, so we are exactly 7 days out from the inauguration of the 47th President of the United States, Donald Trump. I have a feeling we will have lots to talk about in the week and weeks ahead in that regard. So I'll look forward to reconvening as a group later. But Guy Giorno, Andrew House, Alex Steinhaus, Claudia Feldkamp, thanks very much for this lively conversation.